Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much for attending today's sort of session. And we're going to be looking at the diagnosis and treatment of bacterial infections in reptiles. And I think it's fair to say that we reach for antibiotics in the reptiles really all the time. One of the most common treatments that we're going to be giving to them. And I think a lot of people assume that captive reptiles are going to be immunosuppressed. They might perhaps run a hematology, and there's a reduced white cell count, so we're assuming their immune response to react to infections is limited. Added into that sort of equation, obviously, any wounds or illness, we're sort of almost taught that these are going to have multi-resistant gram-negative bacteria present, either as a primary agent or as an opportunistic pathogen. And that then lends to us reaching for antibiotics in that sort of similar sort of way. Now, I suppose the sort of things just to put at you a little bit here is that we do know, of course, that much as we're concerned about maybe multi-resistant gram negatives, there's other infections we've got to be looking at and thinking about. And anaerobic bacteria are significant bacterial infections as well. And looking at sort of papers where swabs have been sent off for culture, I guess, and seeing what grows out, then we're looking around about 40-50% of those culture samples have generated anaerobic organisms. And that sort of might influence our thought process in terms of when and what agents we're going to be considering using. Just a little list here now of some of the commonly identified potential pathogens that we find on samples taken from reptiles. Quite a long list, and you can see there's a few sort of favourites in here that we do expect resistance patterns to be occurring in. But there's none of these that specifically say, I am a primary pathogen, if you culture me, I require treatment. All of these you could culture out from a routine sample, and then you sort of come back onto where did I take my sample from? How reliable is that sample result? It's very easy to take a bacterial culture swab, grow something, get excited by that, and start treatment. But of course, that may be a completely misdiagnosis or error without supportive evidence. And if we look at sort of one of the later papers here looking at resistance trends, and I've just put in here that, for example, Pseudomonas, 10% of the culture submitted, so quite a significant opportunistic pathogen. 75% of those Pseudomonas cultures now are resistant to fluoroquinolones, so that basically wipes out your enrofloxacin, which we have clearly been abusing for many a year. So when we're looking at how we're going to treat bacterial infections in the reptiles, maybe we need to start thinking about, seriously thinking about, do I need antibiotics? And if I do, how am I going to justify their use clinically and try and determine that I'm using the right antibiotic? And that's really where we're going to be starting today's webinar to some extent, is let's go back to the basics and start thinking about what are we going to do here? So identifying a bacteria on a culture, it's not a diagnosis, you've just grown something. We need to confirm that there is a pathological response from the host. We've got to have some signs of inflammatory change, some granulomatous tissues, some signs that we've got heterophils, engulfing bacteria, things like this. And of course, it's one thing having that, but we also need to know that this sample is truly representative. Do I trust this sample? Is this a reliable sample? If this grows something, am I going to be able to act on that? Or have I randomly got a collection of contaminants that are not relevant? So when you're looking at taking your culture samples, realistically, getting a deeper sample before you run antibiotics is probably going to yield you the most reliable results. And what we need to be doing here is not swabbing from pus or the center of an abscess. We need to be taking samples from the periphery of lesions. So really what we're trying to look at here is the interface between active infection, where we've got viable bacteria present, versus taking a sample of the necrotic pus in the center of an abscess, where we're less likely to get a positive culture. And obviously, if we're running a culture and it doesn't grow anything, you get cross because you're unsuccessful. Clients are still paying for that sample to be run. We want to try and maximize the chances of a positive culture. So we do have to be selecting an area where we think we're going to get viable bacteria, getting it into probably a charcoal swab in most cases, absolutely fine. We need to get it to the lab promptly. And to be honest, I'll be sending all of these special delivery, guaranteed next morning delivery. And obviously trying to avoid overgrowth and subsequent death. And if you are going to have delayed transit, then maybe putting that sample into the fridge and keeping it chilled until transport is the way forward. And I suppose, you know, about a fifth of samples you sent would probably fail to grow organisms. So to some extent, the quicker you can get these samples to the lab, the better. I suppose I have the advantage at the university that if I am taking a sample, I can get that plated straight away. You know, literally, I can take the sample in the morning, send it to pathology, they will plate it that day. You don't have that overnight delay, which you would do in the circumstances where you're sending to an external laboratory. So the quicker you can get these plated, the greater the chance of ensuring you are getting bacteria to grow. And just taking an example here for you, looking at an aquatic turtle here now with septicemic cutaneous ulcerative disease. Classically, this is considered to be due to Serratia and Citrobacter, but obviously your amount of surface contaminations are going to be quite marked on this. So if you want to try and get a diagnosis and have a reliable culture result, you need a deeper bone biopsy, for example, here to stand a chance at getting something that you can consider useful. But I suppose when we're sending things for culture, there is a couple of things that we need to be thinking about here as well. Firstly, anaerobic culture, given what we've said a few minutes ago, is something you should be ticking on the box and say, I need an anaerobic culture as well, or else you're going to miss out on a large collection of potential pathogens here. Second thing you need to be doing here is you want a fungal culture. We see a lot of opportunistic fungal infections in the reptiles. We will obviously have Chrysosporium anamorph of Nanosopsis verisi as a primary fungal pathogen in the reptiles. We need to make sure that that isn't present. We're not growing that out as well. So again, you know, looking at lesions here, for example, that just look like they're burns. This is a classical CAMF presentation that we have here. And then we've got to have a little bit of a think about things that could be contributing to this disease that aren't going to grow on routine culture. If we've got mycoplasma present, maybe we might have tuberculosis present, maybe we've got herpes viruses present, things like that, particularly in upper respiratory tract disease in the chelonians, for example, then maybe running your PCRs, ruling out other diseases is quite important as well. Because we need to make sure that we are treating the full range of primary or opportunistic pathogens that are present in that individual, not just knee-jerk reacting to a positive culture. The other thing you might want to be considering then is saying, okay, well, how am I going to confirm now? We've gone through maybe the range of samples you want to take, but now I want to look at this host pathogenic response. I want to try and confirm there's some reaction there. So blood samples are certainly a sensible way to go. What we're looking for here is a systemic response that says I'm having a marked inflammatory response. My white cell count has altered. What's of very importance on the reptile bloods is to look on the film On there, I'm looking for signs of toxic activity. If you've got toxic heterophils on your blood film, that's a suggestion then that this is actively fighting infection. And if you're seeing evidence of bacteria being engulfed or bacteremia on that slide, then obviously that's great. That's confirming this animal is going septic, and therefore you're indicated in giving systemic antibiotics. And just another example here where we do see in some of these where you're getting subcutaneous bruising or hemorrhage, if you like. This is classically considered to be a septic chelonian. This animal actually here has got such severe metabolic bone disease, the shell is starting to fall apart, and this is why it's got the bruising. This is not going septic. This doesn't need antibiotics. And in my head, much as people use this as a, oh my God, you need to get antibiotics on board, I'm not so convinced if you're seeing reddening between shell layers. You'll get that with superficial shell damage. And for me, seeing flushing on the scutes, that's lovely, but I might want to think about other reasons for quantifying the need for antibiotics. You get a similar thing in the snakes as well. I'm not so convinced that it's a reliable indicator of the need for antibiotics. You need other evidence to back up those thought processes going through your head. We also want to then perhaps look at cytology or histopath. And I'd argue this is better to some extent than running your bloods with a lot of the localized treatments you may, localized infections you may be seeing. And again, what we want to see on these, we want to see bacteria with morphology that's consistent with those that we have cultured. And we want to see white cell counts on this slide as well, engulfing these bacteria, showing signs of activity. And obviously on cytology, that's great. That's what we can look for. I'd argue in a lot of cases that histopathology is superior because I want to see if there's underlying viral disease, for example. So if I'm running histopathology, I can see a granulomatous reaction. I can see if there's TB through special stains. I can see if there's fungal elements with special stains. We can rule out the fact this isn't a neoplastic mass that's got secondarily infected on the surface. We can see if there's inclusion bodies from a viral infection as well. I don't really get all these elements from cytology, so maybe histopath is also on our list as well. The one thing I will say, of course, is cytology is fairly instant. You can dab, roll your swab onto a glass slide, do it in-house from the lesion. And I've just put in here, just to remind me, when we're looking at things like respiratory tract disease, upper respiratory tract in chelonians, as we've already discussed, tracheal washes, for example, from here, endoscopic samples, nasal flushes, all of these things can be used to get samples that are more reliable from these individuals for cytology and culture, of course. So just bear that in mind. We're talking a collection of washes in here as well for obtaining your samples. Having got your tracheal wash, nasal flush, then I would diff quick or rapid diff that sample in the clinic. Have a look yourself. We're looking for bacteria. We're looking for heterophils. We're looking for an inflammatory response. Fairly easy, I think, for most of us to have a look for that on our cytology. And just run your slide and start looking to see if you've got a presence of bacteria on that sample that's staining positive that you can do something with. And I've just put on here a ZN stain now, looking for the presence of mycobacteria. The vast majority of mycobacterial infections that we're seeing in the reptiles will be granulomatous. But in addition to that, because these tend to be environmental, sort of avian TB style organisms, you tend to get large numbers present on your slides, whereas if you were looking for mammalian TB, you get much lower numbers. So normally for these, they can be quite obvious if you're seeing them on the slide, if you've got TB present. But again, you're going to have granulomatous disease. You're probably going to be pushing down the route for biopsy in some of these cases. Imaging is on your list. Maybe we need to work out where this infection is. We're trying to hunt for an abscess, looking for a site of osteomyelitis. In this particular case we're showing here, this is a bearded dragon with a pneumonia, with a lake of pus in its air sac. which we're then draining, using for culture, using for cytology. But again, your imaging may be needed to quantify what's going on. It's very easy to focus just on one site, one swollen joint on the leg, and go, okay, let's go and get a culture and check that out. The question then is, well, do I have lesions on other legs that you haven't quite spotted yet that are evident radiographically that aren't obvious yet clinically? Or is this a reflection of a systemic disease process and I've got other lesions in joints that aren't so obvious? So radiographic assessment of the entire patient, if you're thinking osteomyelitis, makes perfect common sense, of course, to evaluate it in more detail. So if you're moving on to biopsies of sites, again, we want deeper samples. Maybe this animal's under anesthesia and we're thinking of doing some debridement for that individual. Again, that's relevant. But make sure you're getting your swab taken before you start on antibiotics. If it's on my list of things to do, then I'll schedule the procedure in first, taking deep samples from my biopsy. I haven't given you antibiotics yet. And again, if I'm going to do that, well, then obviously I'm going to send histopath as well. Back to a turtle here with septicemic cutaneous ulcerative disease. We're getting a biopsy for histopath. We're getting a biopsy, a deeper biopsy for culture. Same applies for skin lesions. There's nothing to stop you taking normal, a routine punch biopsy or surgically removing a little segment. Point on here is you can see we are biopsying at the interface, at the edge of this lesion with normal tissue here, where we've got active growth of whatever organism is contributing to the disease in this case. This actually happens to be another CANV case in a bearded dragon here, but it's just illustrating the point. If they're dead, of course, then we've got to think about getting a diagnosis from a dead creature. Now, ideally, we'd like that to be without any antibiotics prior to being dead. And obviously, to get a reliable culture, you kind of need to take it as the animal is dying. This isn't something you're going to take a day later or 2 days later. We've got so many opportunistics here. Unless you're going to get that culture as you post-mortem it at the point of death, realistically, I wouldn't be taking culture results from post-mortem samples. If you're that concerned, fine, then get your histopath. Let's have a look and try and confirm that we do have, you know, again, consistent inflammatory change with bacterial morphology consistent in the tissue to combine with my culture. I wouldn't be looking at a culture alone from a PM. If you were desperate enough, fine, get a host pathological response with that. And this is just another case here, just to put another case at you here. This is a paramyxovirus virus pneumonia, grew out a multi-resistant pure growth of Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas isn't the pathogen here, it's paramyxovirus. But again, get your histopath. Confirm your changes in the lung is consistent with the what you're getting on culture. And in this case, like I say, you're seeing a classical pneumocyte proliferation with inclusion bodies, if you're lucky to say I've got PMV here, and then you're back on to doing PCRs from this post-mortem analysis. Then we're moving on to sort of having, I suppose, got our diagnosis. We've got to think about how are we going to treat this now then. And I think we've got to start looking at not everything needs systemic antibiotics. We've got a topical stomatitis here in a snake. We've got terrapin here, lots of algal growth over its surface. Water quality here clearly has been quite shocking. So we've got husbandry and management here to sort out in terms of getting them at the preferred temperature zones, as it were, the optimal zones for their immune system to react. Water quality for this terrapin has to be markedly improved. There's no point trying to treat this when we've got this bacterial soup that this poor thing's swimming in. That boils down to filtration. That boils down to testing. That boils down to how am I going to feed it? Where am I feeding it? How much am I feeding it? So lots of husbandry things here. But again, both of these are things that maybe I can treat topically. Another turtle here. Just putting in here, we use a lot of iodine. We use a lot of F10 in our reptiles. Bathing, washes, scrubbing, flushing. All of these sorts of things that we do. Fairly standard and routine. And there's lots of products, of course, marketed for that. And I've just put a bearded dragon here with periodontal disease again. This is something else where you may be looking at using topical treatment. And maybe we should be learning a thing or two from the mammalian side. There's lots of mouthwash washes and preparations we can use to reduce bacterial load in the mouth. But the thing, of course, I think a lot of vets are bad at is actually stopping and thinking about what agents they want to use and why. Flamazine is another firm favourite. We love flamazine cream. We use it a lot on the reptiles too. But all of the agents we've so far discussed, they're toxic to healing tissue. They're going to impair granulation and healing. Okay, what we need to stimulate these wounds to heal, we need to get fluid into the wound. We need to get white cells into that wound. We need to get capillary and neovascularization into that wound to start debriding the area, clearing infection, setting up for a nice granulation bed. And once we've got a granulation bed, we're pretty much resistant to infection at that point. So if you're going to use topical agents that are going to impair leukocyte migration and be epitheliotoxic or damaging to the inflammatory response, it's not going to be helpful. So in most cases, once you're happy that you have surgically debrided a wound, I guess, of necrotic material, maybe you have felt the urge to flush it with some iodine and swill it around for a local kill effect, and you've had sufficient contact time to enable that to occur, and contact time, of course, is quite important. Having done that, then I guess how many people then would rinse out the iodine? How many people would think, I've done my local kill effect I wanted. I'm going to rinse the iodine out now with some saline so it doesn't sit there and continue to kill off cells. And then maybe I'm now going to apply a hydrogel. Maybe I'm going to use honey. Again, we use honey a lot in the mammals. Should be using it in the reptiles too, really. Both of these will stimulate wound healing by enabling fluid to be drawn into the wound, aiding debridement due to an osmotic effect locally, killing off bacteria as well. So maybe we've got to start thinking a bit smarter about how we're going to manage our reptile wounds versus just throwing iodine and flamazine at them because we can. And I think when you're looking at, I just put burns here for an example, again, where we've got lots of pain, superficial infection. If you've got epidermal damage in that your agent is going to be getting into tissues, then using something like flamazine is probably a bad choice because this is going to be damaging to those cells. If this animal's already gone through a shed and it's starting to heal and we just have inflamed or damaged scales, but it's not going to break into lower tissue, then I think flamazine is perfect, to be honest. It's really good analgesic. The silver will control bacterial and fungal infections and works very, very nicely. So don't reject it, but choose your case maybe a bit wiser in terms of how you're going to approach these cases. And you've also got other areas where you may be thinking between topical and systemic. This is basically a cloacal infection in a leopard gecko. What we've got here is impacted hemipenes that have now become necrotic and infected due to, I guess, lack of humidity and poor management of these animals. I mean, obviously, it's very often you're going to have to come in and start hooking out hemipenal plugs from male reptiles. And I just don't think people do that often enough. So this one here is maybe topical, maybe systemic, but I've got to evaluate that a little bit further. And again, this is a cricket bite now on a leopard gecko with a purulent response. Maybe this is topical, maybe systemic. Is the bone infected? I don't know. These are all questions that we need to be looking at answering. And I think with a lot of the cases that we're dealing with, then we've got to think back to surgery of these. And I'm putting surgery here into quite a variety of categories, really, where you've got maybe you need to go in and remove infective material. Maybe that's something that you can do completely and be happy that you've removed it in toto. Maybe it's something that you cannot remove completely and you're thinking, I'm going to be leaving residual infection, I can't avoid that. And then in other cases, when you're looking at antibiotics for these, the top picture here, for example, is a tortoise that was suffered rodent nibbling during hibernation to the extent that it's lost most of its leg here. Okay, there's no gross signs of infection per se, but there's going to be infection present here. So again, I've got to think about what sort of opportunistic pathogens may be invading this sort of tissue from the skin surface, but also from the rodent's teeth, for example. Bottom picture here, chelonian again, dog bite wound. Again, you've got impregnation of material from the teeth of the dog, skin of the chelonian, maybe some soil, maybe some poo has all been smeared. There's a whole collection of things that could be smeared into this wound in the process of this trauma. So think also about pathogens coming from the environment and from, I guess, the aggressor in the case that you do have another animal involved. So some of these, they're just a collection of abscesses here. We've got an oral abscess in a chelonian here, where we're hopeful we're going to be removing all of the infection. But again, we might have infection in the tympanic bullet in the lining, or there may be an osteomyelitis and destruction of the bone around this site. Maybe we need to be looking at that, and maybe this just isn't a question of popping it out. Maybe we do need treatment alongside that. We have a terrapin, the subcutaneous abscess on its neck now, resulting from a bite wound from another terrapin. This is probably one that I can remove completely surgically if I'm careful, with no contamination of my surgical site, remove it in toto and solve that problem. Maybe my need for systemic antibiotics then for this case is maybe short-lived or perisurgery, but not protracted time period. And again, we've got another little lizard now, just again with another subcutaneous abscess. I'm hopeful I can shell this out in one go and have minimal need for systemic antibiotics. And like I say, in the circumstances where you can achieve that, great. Get your abscess out completely. Be very meticulous in your surgery. Flush the area afterwards copiously. Primary wound closure. Maybe antibiotics perisurgically, but probably no real need for any at home. Again, if you're dealing with osteomyelitis or more awkward style infections, then we're going to have infected material left. We're going to try our best, but we're going to have infected material left, and our approach has to be slightly different for these cases. And just another quick picture here now. This is a snake that was bitten by us, another snake. We've obviously got a massive granulomatous reaction here in its nose, lots of red and inflamed tissue. This really is a case, to be honest, that needs a CT of its head to get answers for you. But again, we're going to have residual infection here. That's inevitable, and we've got to try and manage this alongside that. So having gone through and done the best you can surgically at debriding these, we then move on to what antibiotics do I need and how am I going to get those into the patient. Local therapy is one that I think classically has been used a lot in the exotics, where we're using antibiotic impregnated beads. Essentially, we're using human gentamicin bone cement that's used for hip replacements. You can add in clindamycin powder to this, and that will give you aerobic and anaerobic cover in these individuals. And these obviously can be applied locally into that site. And even if we're concerned about the systemic effects of some of these agents in some species, this really is local therapy that doesn't have that as a side effect. The downside is you do need to have a team of people getting ready to make them up. The bone cement dries quite quick, so you do need to have everybody ready to create these for you. If we're moving on to giving parenteral antibiotics to your reptiles, then okay, we're going intramuscular, would be fairly standard. For snakes, we're going to use the Apexia muscles over the either side of the spine. Lizards, we might inject over the rib cage or into limb muscles for those. And chelonians, I tend to use a pectoral muscle mass these days. It's less painful than injecting into the limbs. It's easier to disinfect. It's less contaminated than the lower legs might be. So for me, this would be my preferred chelonian site. You do have to be aware that if you're jabbing a lizard, such as an anole or a chameleon, then you may get discoloration at the injection site, that you can get a melanophore excitation that can move to the tops of the cells, leading to discoloration as a pain response. So just showing you here with a snake, again, clean that site, go in between scales, not into a scale to inject. And this is just going over the rib cage here now in a rather thin little leopard gecko. Senegal chameleon here. This animal actually has had hemipenal surgery due to infection. And we can see we've got a melanophore pigmentation at the surgical site, which obviously is causing this animal some pain and distress. It's also had an emrafloxacin injection, and you can see that has excitated the melanophores as well. This will settle, but your owner needs to be aware that you're going to get this colour change in these species. And this is the pectoral muscle site that I will be using in the chelonians. Easy to do solo. You can clean the area quite nicely. And it just seems far more practical than using the legs. See, one other thing we do have to be careful with the reptiles is the glomerular filtration rate can be switched off completely in order to save fluid. So basically, in terms of dehydration, they'll shut down the glomerulus activity, shunting the blood away from the kidneys, and then they have a renal portal system which delivers blood to the nephrons that arises from the tail and the back legs. And this basically means there's enough blood going to the nephrons to maintain viability. Because the glomerular filtration rate has been shut down, then this, of course, reduces the amount of urine they produce. And because they have reptilian nephrons, they're unable to concentrate that urine, so they have to use post-renal modification in the cloaca or colon to reabsorb that fluid. So if we can shut down our GFR, we're saving fluid. Two concerns here, really, I suppose, is one, your patient is clearly quite sick, and maybe we need to be looking at rehydrating it before administering anything nephrotoxic. The second thing here, of course, is any drug you're putting into the back end of the reptile could go straight to the kidneys if it goes into the renal portal system. So in those circumstances, hydrate first before therapy. But if you're going to use something that's going to be excreted via the nephrons, such as a penicillin, for example, then maybe inject that into the cranial part of the reptile. And given it's quite difficult to work out which drug is nephron excreted and which drugs are glomerular versus something else, then maybe injecting into the front half of all your reptiles just solves the entire discussion and ends the problem. If we're going to gavage our reptiles with treatment, that's grand. We do a lot of that. You want to protect the tube you're going to be using from the animal's teeth. This is a green iguana. Being fairly typical green iguana, really, is putting a lot of pressure on my tongue depressor. I put some vet wrap around here so it doesn't damage its teeth. But again, we don't want these guys to be crunching on a solid tube and damaging their teeth in the process. The solid tubes we use for birds work brilliantly. You can attach them to your size syringe that you like. They are lure fitting, so if you want to thread a lure syringe onto this so the animal can't swallow your crop tube by accident, that's absolutely fine for you to do that. And if you're going to go for gavage therapy, like I say, get your tongue depressor into the mouth of the lizards to ensure they can't bite on that. For the snakes, we'll just be using a urinary catheter. Pass that down the centre of the mouth to avoid the two rows of teeth that they've got either side. About 50% of the snout to vent length will get you down into the stomach for the snakes. Although to be often with the snakes is quite difficult going for the gavage therapy because of intermittent feeding. You have to stress them out to do that, and I think most snakes we would be injecting in preference. For the Chelonians, oral therapy works fine until they realise that you're doing it, and they can then become quite belligerent and resistant to that once they've decided they don't like the idea. But again, I tend to use the metal tubes for those. 50% of the length and on over the abdominal scutes will get you into the stomach quite nicely. There are circumstances where you may be thinking that I want to go for oral therapy, but I'm going to put it in food for a bigger group. Some of the aquatic chelonians, for example, that may be more difficult to inject or catch. And we do in a very similar sort of way to we would do for the fish, for example, where we would use gelatin, cool that gelatin, mix it. In this case, we've gone for enrofloxacin again, top dress it over the turtle pellets. And obviously, then you've got a therapy you can give in food. And if you're thinking coming back to trying to give oral therapy to maybe some of the larger, more belligerent chelonians, like a sulcata, for example, it's almost impossible to pull the head out to get deworming treatment in, for example. Maybe there's other alternatives we should be looking at for that. So, having gone through that process, I guess the final thing we're at now is we've got to think about what antibiotics we want to use in these individuals. Now we thought about how we're going to confirm we've got a bacterial infection and how we're going to get it in. We've got to think about what agents we're going to be considering using. And I've put cefovecin here as the first one here. Pseudomonas is inherently resistant to this, and the half-life in reptiles is incredibly short. It's related to protein binding and it's species specific. So, cefovecin is one that is not on my list for use in the reptiles. Enrofloxacin, as I said, we do have concerns with massive resistance to fluoroquinolones collectively now. It is, of course, licensed. It is bactericidal. It does have activity against aerobes. It doesn't have activity against your anaerobes. So, if we're thinking we've got anaerobic infections present with this animal, enrofloxacin is not relevant to that extent. Some species it's converted to ciprofloxacin, and that's okay. It does have inherent activity against Pseudomonas, but again, resistance is becoming a problem now. The other thing that's worth noting with the fluoroquinolones is we do have activity against mycoplasma. So if you're thinking you've got a clinical presentation where mycoplasma is relevant, or you have a positive mycoplasma culture, again with consistent clinical signs of active infection with mycoplasma, then enrofloxacin does come back onto your list. Dosage regime for enrofloxacin is very, very variable. There isn't a standard reptile dose really, and I'm not going to dwell on it in too much detail for the purposes of the webinar today, but basically you're looking at 5 to 10 mg per kg between 1 and 5 days, depending on species. I think most people are on 5 mg per kg every other day or daily by injection if they're not sure, and orally tends to be a daily dosing that you would consider as well. Ceftazidime is another agent that we kind of have abused quite a lot as well. It's a third generation cephalosporin. It specifically covers resistant gram negatives. It will deal with aerobes. It will deal with anaerobes. It will not cover mycoplasma. And basically, it's made up and it's basically active for 24 hours and then it's done. So if you're being practical and following pharmaceutical guidelines, you make up a vial of ceftazidime, you use that within the day, and you discard it. A lot of people will be using fridged ceftazidime for a week. Maybe it'll be frozen as well, and it might last a bit longer. But I must admit, we're very much tending away from this protracted freezing of ceftazidime simply because our pharmacist is getting very cross at us abusing the methods in which we're giving these agents to our patients, and we should be really stepping up our game and being a bit more responsible. So for us, the ceftazidime, now we don't freeze it anymore. We keep it for a couple of days in the fridge if we're really desperate to use it. But beyond that, we try and use a vial as we use it, which does mean then you're charging the client for the vials as you open them. Aminoglycosides are great, really. Tend to use amikacin in preference to gentamicin, simply because of concerns that maybe this is less nephrotoxic. They must be hydrated. Get some decent culture results to confirm you need to use them in my books, although a lot of people will reach for aminoglycosides first line. Dosage rate, sort of 5 mg per kg every 3 days. They won't do anaerobes, just the aerobes, and they will not cover mycoplasma either. This leads you on to, what if I do want to give anaerobic cover alongside aminoglycoside or a fluoroquinolone, and then maybe I will be reaching for metronidazole. It complements them quite nice. Use it orally, 20 to 50 mg per kg for antibacterial activity. Obviously, it does also have anti-protozoal activity as well against the ciliates primarily. Good penetration into pus. Great. Or aerobes, of course, are inherently resistant. There is no point asking for a metronidazole culture from an aerobic culture. We don't use doxycycline that much in the reptiles. Some people have tried it and use it and quite like it. It obviously has a very wide spectrum of activity, including your mycoplasma, aerobes, anaerobes, and some rickettsial or two. But it's bacteriostatic. And if we're going back onto the thought process that reptiles' immune response is impaired, then really we should perhaps be thinking about using a bactericidal agent on every occasion. I put ciprofloxacin up here. Much as we are getting a lot of fluoroquinolone resistance, ciprofloxacin, I guess, is a sort of parental drug, really. And you might find where you've got enrofloxacin resistance, you might not have resistance to ciprofloxacin, and you may still have activity there that works for that one. Timentin is another one to reach for when you start to struggle. Timentin basically is ticosylin, which is an anti-pseudomonal penicillin, combined with cravulinic acid. So I think of this as being sort of super Sinulox, really. If you need to, again, it's sort of 100 mg per kg every other day, or 50 mg per kg per day dosing is recommended. Slight downside is it is an infusion thing. It should be used within 24 hours. We don't actually stock it as a routine in a hospital now, but if I've got a culture result that suggests I need this and the owner's prepared to fund it, then we can get the time entering within 24 hours and use that. And I've put sulfonamides here as well. I'm not a great fan of using the sulfonamides in the reptiles, but I know other people are. A lot of people, when they're dealing with non-specific sick bearded dragons, maybe would reach for sulfonamides simply because we've got anticoccidiosis effect as well here. And if you've got a GI upset, then maybe you're reaching for a sulfonamide for those individuals. Again, use your formularies, think about your doses, and think about how you're going to get these in. You've got to have patient and owner compliance to get these agents on board. This is the end of the webinar, but we do have a very good question that has been raised actually from the people listening in. And the question basically is if I was forced into it, what would be my first choices? What sort of things would I be looking at to administer to reptiles? And I think for me, much as I'm potentially being a bad person here because I would be reaching for some of the higher generation antibiotics. I think arguably there's sort of four scenarios here. The first one is if I'm doing surgery, I'm anticipating potential contamination of that surgical site but there's no inherent infection at the minute, what would I be treating with? I'd probably go for ceftazidime every 3 days by injection. And I'd probably be treating for 2 or 3 doses, depending on how I feel. If the surgery was pretty clear and uncontaminated, then maybe I'd just give the 1 dose. If I thought there was some contamination, maybe I'd be treating for a couple of weeks. If, of course, I've got in a situation where I think there is infection present and I want to be giving treatment with antibiotics, either I haven't had the opportunity to get a culture or I'm pending culture results, which I guess in this day and age I'm pretty much making people take cultures, I'd probably be on ceftazidime again, but maybe now a month's duration because I feel there is significant infection and that increase in duration is warranted. The next scenario would be, what if I've got a severe infection that's evident, the animal's gone septic, we're thinking it's critically quite ill, and I want to try and cover as many bases as possible, then I probably will be combining ceftazidime with enrofloxacin because I'm getting hopefully increased kill from the fluoroquinolone due to the action of the ceftazidime, and that they're going to be synergistic, as well as ensuring I've got mycoplasma cover as well, I suppose. So severe, sinister, I would be picking on those two, again, waiting for a culture result. And my final category is where I think there is significant mycoplasmal involvement here, and then in those circumstances, I would be going for my enrofloxacin. Again, pending PCRs, pending culture results, but that would kind of be my first choice, again, parenterally. If we look at then oral antibiotics for the reptiles, I'd probably be going for oral enrofloxacin, although I have had induced invasive candidiasis as a result of doing that. If I want anaerobic cover as well, then I would be going for metronidazole. I love metronidazole. It's very effective. In many cases, I'd be combining the two if I was concerned that there was anaerobic involvement. And again, if I was just routinely covering it, then maybe I would be falling back on my Ceftrin. But in most circumstances, I wouldn't be going down that route, to be honest with you. I wouldn't be administering antibiotics randomly just because I could to a reptile. I think I'd want some clinical justification. And if I'm operating on them, they're an inpatient anyway, so I can inject them. You know, if I needed to go down that route, otherwise I'm trying to confirm significant infection by some other method. I'm now going to pass you back to Aimer. Thank you for attending the webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.